19 January. The Coyoacan house is proving a good accommodation. Old houses have their wisdom. Despite the bricked-up exterior, the main rooms are comfortably lit by the courtyard. That jungle enclosed by high blue walls is a comforting world for visitors who are not at great liberty to roam elsewhere. Perpetua is taking care with her lilies and figs. It remains a cheerful world, in no way resembling a prison. Perpetua said Guillermo had this house built for his family more than 30 years ago, and through all those years no one saw a need for turning it upside down until now. Her resentment of the current upheaval is understandable. The deep adobe walls keep a good temperature all day. The contrasts between this house and the modern one built by the Riveras in San Angel are many, most particularly their kitchens. But on that subject, no opinion is given here. Senora Frida's choice of blue walls is greatly approved by all here. A note on meal preparations. The visitors prefer tea over coffee. Another exceptional preference is unsweetened bread cut into thin slabs, toasted in the oven until somewhat hard, as if stale. Otherwise, they are generally agreeable to normal foods. Natalia made plain their disinterest in pickled fish after a long Norwegian winter of almost nothing else. They request mashed turnips and a green vegetable unknown to these parts, translated by Van as the sprouts of Belgium. Tomorrow, Perpetua will be driven into the city on a search, as the Melchor market here has neither tea nor turnip. But they are adapting well to customary foods. Sugared fritters, baked guava, and fermented cream are all favored. This morning they took enchiladas with eggs and tea. On days when no special meals are scheduled, all hands go to helping Lev unpack and arrange his study. He is curious about Mexico, the altitude of mountains, population of the city, its history, and so forth. Perpetua, on her trip to town, is to fetch the geographic atlas owned by H.S. from his mother's apartment. It is outdated, but will serve for now. Pico de Orizaba has not changed its height in a decade. Lev communicates with help from the secretary Van, since Lev's Spanish and English are rudimentary, and clever Van seems to speak everything possible, French, Norwegian, Russian. He claims both French and Dutch as native tongues. He makes a point of moving the largest crates, insisting no extra help is needed in Lev's office. It can't be argued, really. Van is tall and strong as an ox, though more handsome. He complains sometimes in English about the so-called native typist, apparently not realizing H.S. also has two native tongues. But Lev is agreeable to having an extra fellow to help him. Plainly, Van has a habit of protecting his chief from outsiders, which is natural. He first became Lev's assistant in France, where they lived from 1933 until 1935. That was before Norway. Prior to that, Lev and Natalia were hiding in Istanbul, and before that, Kazakhstan. Lev Davidovich has been living in exile under threat of death since 1927. "I am a man in a very large world," he said slowly today, "with a very small place to be." "Mexico is fairly good-sized, sir. You'll see." Van said, "He's speaking metaphorically. He means that he lives in the planet without a passport." 21 January. A telegraphed message came this morning, delivered by Diego wearing his holster and gun. The message was in a code. Lev spent many hours in his study working it out, rejecting even Van's offers of help, with Natalia the whole time walking between the study and the kitchen, pulling on her fingers, making Perpetua burn the milk. The message concerns the sun in Paris. Van says there are two sons. The younger was taken to prison camp 3 years ago, almost certainly dead. two daughters, are also dead. Lev is not very sure of the message, except for one important part. The telegram is definitely from Lyova, so he is alive. They have a code for his identity that is known to no one else on Earth, not even Natalia. Lev speculates that GPU killers in France have tried to assassinate Lyova, and we can expect the newspapers to report him killed. To spare distress, he wanted his parents to know he is alive, in hiding. They seem little spared from distress, though. If her son escaped murder this time, Natalia asks, what about the next? Lev rages that his children have done nothing to earn a death sentence from Stalin. The younger one, Sergei, only ever cared for books, sport, and girls, but ended in a concentration camp. And now Lyova, his crime is to be the son of his father. Who can change the things that brought him into the world? 23 January. Diego arrived early, upset, with the bundle of newspapers he receives by special post. Two report the death of Lyova, as predicted, but they know this is false. There is worse news yet. Headlines declaring L.D. Trotsky found guilty of crimes against the Soviet Union. His trial in Moscow has been going on for weeks, with the accused in absentia. Van says Lev petitioned to go there and stand trial for the chance to defend himself, but Stalin wouldn't lift the exile order. The aim of the trial is to discredit anyone who ever spoke against Stalin. Some of Lev's friends are also declared guilty, men named Radek, Pyatakov, and Muralov, all three imprisoned now in Moscow. The charges are strange and diverse. Derailing trains, collaborating with Rudolf Hess and the Nazis, acting as agents of the Japanese emperor, stealing bread, attempting to assassinate Stalin by poisoning his shoes and his hair cream. Stalin uses hair cream? Careful, lad, said Lev. That knowledge alone could get you the firing squad. The penalty for the charges against Lev is death. Yet he seems in good spirits, despite the newspapers from France and the United States calling him a villain, and the Mexican ones calling him a villain in our midst. The editorials speculate on why he betrayed his principles. These newspaper men have never met Lev, yet confidently they discuss his innermost feelings and motives. They take it on faith that the treacheries were all committed. They don't even wonder how a man could derail so many Russian trains after he was put on a cargo boat for Prinkipo Island. The security regimes here are strictly maintained. As the news makes clear, Stalin intends to have Lev assassinated. The guard in the street changes hourly. Lorenzo organizes drills in which Lev and Natalia must be hidden very quickly. When Diego comes in the car, Lev has to move to one of the inner rooms before the court gates are opened to let the car drive in. Snipers could be in Allende Street, waiting for a line of fire into the courtyard. And if any unknown person comes to the door, even a grocer's boy delivering eggs and flour, the intruder is patted down, relieved of belt and shoes, and made to open all packages for inspection. The GPU will certainly strike, and no one knows how they will do it, though entering in the guise of a grocer seems unlikely. Lev says he has been a revolutionary from the age of 17, with a gallows waiting for him somewhere for 40 years. His friends will know these new charges against him are invented. And my enemies know it also. Which of these has written anything new? He threw the newspapers aside and made Natalia come and sit on his knee. She obeyed him, but with a frown on her bottom lip, like the little dogs that have long wool in their eyes and a flattened nose. Lev took off his round-rimmed spectacles and sang to her in Russian. He asked to hear some songs of the Mexican Revolution. Perpetua knew a surprising number. For such an old cook, her voice is steady. January 24. Lev and Natalia went for a stroll in the Melchor Market, their first venture outside the house since arrival. Between all the guards and Diego's machine gun, Coyoacan village must have entertained a commotion. But the so-called villain in our midst means to hold his bearded chin up to the world without shame. With Lev and Natalia out strolling and all the guards escorting, the house was quiet. A slow afternoon passed, helping Van file cartons of Lev's letters and published writings. It's hard to believe such an outpouring of words could come from one man. The Commissar, Van calls him. He works each day as if the calendar on his desk were on its last page, which it could well be. Today, while he was out, Van took the opportunity to ask many questions not friendly, place of birth, education, and so forth. He revealed some scraps of his own life, a difficult childhood, the French mother losing her citizenship for marrying a Dutch husband who died soon after Van's birth. Van has a weakness for what he calls Nederland licorices. They look like black glass beads in a packet he keeps in the desk drawer, guarded rather anxiously, as he is sure they can't be bought in Mexico. Here are two fatherless boys, then, eager to be anything for Lev, with his own two sons so far gone from him, and the man so kind. Already Lev remembers which assistant takes sugar in his tea. He puts everyone through stretching exercises so they won't get backaches while typing what he himself stayed up all night to write. But Van will always be the favored son, of course. He has served Lev so long. Van was surprised to learn the native typist is also of hybrid origin, half gringo. He changed to speaking English after that. His Spanish is very imperfect. He needs help with interpreting at the political meetings, especially when the talk flies around the table like a flock of crows. Last evening, it flew from Russian to English for Mr. Novak, then Spanish for the Rivera's colleagues, then back to Russian, with some French thrown in by Van, just for show, it seemed. Excuse this opinion, if it is one, but as Senora Frida can plainly recall, no one at that meeting needed French. All papers filed today were letters from the past 4 years, most in French, but some typed in Russian, pages of characters in that strange alphabet lined up like rows of little men doing bending exercises. So it's untrue that typewriters are restricted to the characters of the English language. Van cracked his composure and smiled at the story of Officer Gringo and the Potomac Academy typewriters. He understands Spanish well enough to laugh at the joke about Senor Villanueva and his Anos in the Bano. Or, he pretended, he seems fearful of losing his position as his commissar's sole interpreter. With apologies here to Senora Frida, because the last paragraph undoubtedly contains at least one opinion, but not a fiction. The second weekly household report from Coyoacan is herein submitted for her inspection. January 30. A wire came from Paris. Radek, Pyatakov, and Muralov were executed in Moscow. Lev's spirits flag. More of his friends are dead. But he stays absorbed in work. What the newspapers say about Lev is shocking. Charges more improbable every day. Lev said that when the public nerve is aroused, the most impressive capacity of man is his skill for lying. Van said, "It's good to hear you indignant, Commissar." But Lev maintained he was not at all indignant. He was holding a Russian newspaper with such ink-stained fingers he could be a printing press. "I'm speaking as a naturalist, stating fact. The urge to lie is produced by the contradictions in our lives. We are made to declare love for our country while it tramples our rights and dignity." "But newspapers have a duty to truth," Van said. Lev clucked his tongue. They tell the truth only as the exception. Zola wrote that the mendacity of the press could be divided into two groups. The yellow press lies every day without hesitating, but others, like the Times, speak the truth on all inconsequential occasions so they can deceive the public with the requisite authority when it becomes necessary. Van got up from his chair to gather the cast-off newspapers. Lev took off his glasses and rubbed his eyes. I don't mean to offend the journalists. They aren't any different from other people. They are merely the megaphones of the other people. It's true, sir. The newspapers are like the howlers on Isla Pichol. Lev seemed interested in the comparison and changed from English to Spanish. What are these howlers? He asked. A kind of monkey, very terrifying. They howl every morning. First one starts, then a neighbor hears it and starts his own howl, as if he can't help it. Soon the whole forest is bellowing, loud as thunder. It's their nature. Probably they have to do it, to hold their place in the forest, to tell the others no one has gotten the best of them. You are a naturalist also, Lev said. He struggled, but was determined to continue the conversation in Spanish. Van left the office. Where are these creatures? Isla Pichol. It's a coastal island south of Veracruz. A monkey does not swim. How did they become isolated? An isla, he said. Probably he meant en una isla, on an island. It wasn't always an island, sir. An isthmus of rocks connected it with the mainland, but they dredged it for a shipping channel. It was during Maximilian, I think. The monkeys that had gone out there couldn't get back. 22 February. The jacaranda in the courtyard has put on its bloom. This purple can't be ignored. It's like a tree singing. The walk down Londres Street to the market is a concert. The small jacaranda on the corner hums the tuning note. Then all others in the lane join in. Even Perpetua has a light in her eye, holding one hand to her flat old bosom as she takes the cucumbers out of the market basket, one by one. From Lev's study, the view from the end window is a solid blaze of purple. Van sits there to take dictation from the ediphone, with his square profile framed against the window like Poseidon in a purple sea. Or some Teutonic god who causes all he touches and the air itself to burst into purple flames. It is not a fiction or opinion to report that he is breathtaking. Perpetua is not the only one in this house thinking of cucumbers. 1 March. Octavio apprehended a man with a repeater in the alley. After every fresh newspaper rant on the villain residing in Coyoacan, these men show up. So far, it's only citizen desperados vowing to protect their wives. Lev fears more sophisticated men, Communist Party operatives working under command of Stalin's GPU. But a bullet from a barefoot soldier is no less deadly than from a well-paid one. Lorenzo sleeps in the front dining room now. Those lovely windows will have to be closed with brick. The masons have made a mess, and Van had to move into the tiny cupboard with HS, close quarters for two, though he left his multitude of serge jackets in a trunk in the other room. This week is too hot for early spring, and this week the household staff are banned from the front of the house due to the government officials negotiating there late into the night. The heat in this bricked-up cloister is unbearable. Van is dismayed at being held out of the meetings, but Diego says it's sensitive. President Cárdenas is expected here himself to help arrange the commission of inquiry for Lev. After cooking and serving supper, Washing up, tidying, and sweeping, nothing is left for the staff but to sit on cots in these tiny rooms, in undershorts and gobshirts, smoking panetelas, telling exaggerated stories to pass the time. It's like being at school. These are not brotherly feelings Van inspires. Mother would say, Van is plenty rugged. March 3. The guards spend every long evening all in one small room, breathing the same exhaled air and drinking one another's spit from one warm jug of pulque, playing cards for pesos, boredom games. Earlier this evening, the usual one. Name your one wish. If you could have it, then die tomorrow. Boys at school played this, reliably coming round to getting hands on some celebrated pair of tetas. Van, from his high place, added to the earnest list, success of the commissar's revolution. He was on the cot and everyone else on the floor, passing the cigarette packet. You, Shepherd, name yours. To make something beautiful that people would find very moving. Pendejo, you do that every day in the kitchen. I mean a work of art that isn't in the toilet pot by the next day. A story, or something like that. Like the murals of Rivera, commanding men to rise from their knees and fight, Lorenzo said. Stewed or not, loyal to the cause. Or smaller, like the paintings she does. Something people would find dear. Querido, that's all you want, sheepdog? Our shepherd, Van said, leaning out to pat a shaggy head as if it belonged to his dog, in front of the other men. The small dog panted. 10 March. A wire from Mr. Novak, now back in New York. He has persuaded Professor John Dewey to chair the Commission of Inquiry. Some American journalists will follow the story to Mexico. Diego and Lev are extremely happy, as it will give Lev opportunity to answer Stalin's charges for the world to hear. Noted that Senora Frida, after inspecting last week's record of events, repeats her request that it remain objective, especially with regard to the Secretary Van. April 6. Professor John Dewey of Columbia University arrived today by train from New York. He will preside over the Joint Commission of Inquiry into the charges made against Lev Davidovich Trotsky in the Moscow trials. He and seven journalists will reside for the month at the San Angel Inn. The opening press conference will be there, honoring Professor Dewey's wish for fairness and no contact with the defendant prior to hearings. The proceedings will be held here because of special needs for Lev's security. The attorney for Lev's defense, Mr. Goldman from Chicago, arrives by train tomorrow. Sandbags are being laid across Londres to close the neighborhood to traffic. Extreme publicity is expected during the trial. The Mexico City newspapers are already having a run of extras on the subject of the villain in our midst. April 10, first session of the Joint Commission of Inquiry. Professor Dewey opened, thanked Mexican government for its political democracy, stated no man should be condemned without a chance to defend himself. I have devoted my life to the business of enlightening minds in the interest of society. I accept my responsibilities in this commission for one reason. To do otherwise would be false to my life's work. The responsibility is to investigate charges of sabotage and sedition brought by Stalin against the defendant. Defendant is Lev Davidovich Trotsky, born 1879. Fought as anti-czarist from age 17. Led the Bolshevik Revolution. Elected president of the Petrograd Soviet in 1917. Author of the Manifesto of the Third International Comintern, 1919. Expelled from the Soviet Communist Party in 1927. forced into exile in Kazakhstan at that time. At the table with the defendant are his wife, his lawyer, and Van, who has the job of producing requested documents. At a table near it, two Americans and H.S., who are to translate and record all questions posed to Lev and his answers. A man named Glotzer, American, is official court reporter and knows a language, shorthand, that allows writing everything very fast, but only if he understands the words. So all proceedings go to English for his sake, and of course for Professor Dewey's. Therefore, H.S. has the duty to record and translate any questions asked or answered in Spanish. None today, only testimony. Cross-examination begins tomorrow. 12 April. One question in Spanish today from Señor Pontón of the Sociedad de Naciones, translated as follows. Sir, for our Mexican correspondents, I beg you the trouble of answering. Your persistent charge against Stalin is a lack of democracy. Is that correct? Lev answered, correct. A rank of party workers has been created who enter the government and renounce their own opinions, or at least any open expression of them. Every page on their desks comes from above. They behave as if the hierarchy had already created all party opinion and decisions. From this hierarchy, every decision affecting the country stands in the form of a command. When Lev isn't speaking, he puts his feet on the table and leans back in his chair. Today, he reached such an extreme backward angle, it seemed the GPU might not be needed to crack the man's head. But he was still listening. He looks down his Russian nose, and his whole lower face crumples into his collar when he concentrates. He has no consciousness of how he must look to others, only aiming his mind with such a ferocious focus that it could set all those bureaucrats' papers to flames. This must be the countenance of a revolutionary. This daily record complete and submitted for 12/37. April 13. Señor Pontón's question and Lev's answer have gone on the front page of today's Washington Post, exactly as translated by H.S. and quoted again on the editor's page in a discussion of the Moscow trials and the commission. The article even used the description of Mr. Trotsky leaning in his chair, and the headline in very bold letters was, "The Countenance of a Revolutionary." These were only some notes and doodles submitted with the translation transcript, Senora Frida. This is a shock and a terror. The very first try at translation, and some notes jotted on a whim, now on display for the world to read. It was hard to think about breakfast this morning. Perpetua said, "Sit down and stop shaking, mijo. It's a bad start to the week for a man who's hanged on Monday." Hanging is what it feels like. A 20-year-old Galopino who knows nothing about politics could have mistaken yes for no, a renunciar for a renacer, and then what? History could hang on it. Lives could be lost for the sake of a wrong word. No wonder writers are pessimistic. Better to be a cook, where a mistake will only send someone away hungry, or at worst, to the W.C. But Van complimented the translation. He read the article to Lev and Natalia at breakfast, translating it back to Russian as he went. They listened to the words of a cook, while eating toasted bread for which the same nervous cook had already burned his knuckles. 14 April. After the day's hearings closed today, Lev went to the front door to see the huge crowd gathered there. Not only newsmen, but workers of all sorts, even laundry women. No barefoot soldiers want to kill him anymore after hearing his fiery defense of the worker and peasant reported in the news. Now he's afraid they'll want to knock Jesus off the pallets of the Holy Week processions this week and put Trotsky up there instead. A group from the miners' syndicate walked here all the way from Michoacán. He spoke to the crowd in Spanish, slowly but well. I am here because your country believes with me in democratic government and the worker control of industry. Our efforts cannot succeed in an empty space. Probably he meant a vacuum. True change will come from an international organization of workers for world revolution. The crowd has been quiet all day, but at those words they roared. Nearly every day, he takes small pauses from his writing to practice Spanish with the native typist. Van doesn't like the distraction, pointing out that translators are always at the ready. And Lev says, trust an old revolutionary to trust no one completely. He was teasing, it seemed. But today, as he spoke directly to the crowd, his purpose was clear. 15 April. A long day of hearings. Mr. Dewey says it's nearly concluded, but the crowd still grows, both the number of foreigners inside and the Mexicans outside. Lev has such a passion for this hearing, he wouldn't mind if it went on until the sun burned cold. Van seems content beside his chief, undaunted by the army of observers, Mexican and foreign reporters in fedoras and rolled-up shirt sleeves, magazine writers, even some novelists, watching Van's every move as he fishes into the paper caverns of the files with his long fingers, retrieving whatever obscure page Lev might need, indicated only by a word, a date, or a person's name. They are like father and son, Lev and Van. Very few questions in Spanish today. Señor Pontón of the Sociedad de Naciones has the most. Today he had two. The first, sir, is it your position that a worker's state could genuinely honor suffrage and all democratic rights as in a social democracy? Lev's reply, why should it not be so? Even now, in all the capitalist countries, communists take part in the parliamentary struggle. When we achieve a workers' state, there is no difference in principle in the way we will use suffrage, freedom of the press, assembly, and so forth. Second question. Sir, you say the Soviet Union under Stalin is a degenerated workers' state, controlled by an undemocratic bureaucracy. You predict this corruption will be overthrown by a political revolution, establishing a democracy of the working class, or that it will continue to degenerate under world pressure into a purely capitalist state. In either case, can you rationalize the costs to society? Lev answered, young man, you make a point. Humanity has never succeeded in rationalizing its history. Much harm comes from leaders who insist that for every advance, someone else must slide backward. The dictatorship of the Soviet Secretariat came about because of the backwardness and isolation of the country, for so long imposed on us by the Tsar. We were accustomed to the rationalizing of a despot. People accept what they have already known. When mankind is exhausted, he creates new enemies, new religions. Our best task is to move forward without seeking to do so. April 17. The commission has ended its work after 13 sessions. If it went another day, the dining room of this house would crack like an egg. Lev closed with his usual vigor. The experience of my life has not destroyed my faith in the clear, bright future of mankind. At age 18, I entered the workers' quarters of Nikolaev with nothing but a boy's belief in reason, truth, and human solidarity. My faith since then has become more mature, but no less ardent. Every hand stopped. The reporters looked as if they might need handkerchiefs. Mr. Dewey said, "Sirs, anything I could say after that would be a waste of breath." Mr. Dewey and colleagues will consider the evidence and find the defendant guilty or not guilty. They will take many weeks before releasing their written verdict. But Lev is jubilant. Before the world, he has answered the charges. April 28. The house is calming to the previous routines. If calm describes a man who works like three, signaling the typist to finish a letter and bring a book while he dictates political theories into the microphone of the wax cylinder recording machine. It's very warm, even working in shirt sleeves. Van is always last to remove his tweed jacket. An unexpected brush of his hand when he reaches for a book feels like boiling water. Van and Lev are both men of northern temperaments, yet Van seems agitated by Mexico's vivid sun and landscapes, while Lev seems enlivened. He even loves the cactus. 1 May. Senora Frida has continued her daily visits here since the hearings ended, making sure Lev is content. Let it be noted here, bringing Fulang Chang to cheer the place up may not be helpful. Natalia despises the monkey, and yesterday, while Senora Frida was in the kitchen, gave him a whack on the skull with a Conservative Party newspaper. Lev is energized by the news of the workers' uprising in Barcelona, citing it as a sign that the Third International Agreement between Stalin and the world's other communist parties has collapsed. Lev has been asked to write a fourth set of internationalist agreements, hence his frenetic rush of words congealed into wax cylinders from his ediphone. The alternative to Stalin's Comintern now sits in jars on the desk, waiting to be transformed into typewritten words, and then the actions of men. To celebrate, the household staff is complying with Senora Frida's requests to prepare for her fourth international party. Senor Rivera is more worried about security than table decoration. 2 May. The dance. Lev was already in his study when Senora Frida arrived this morning to take over the dining room before Natalia had eaten her breakfast, so she ate in the kitchen. Begging pardon, but please let it be noted, this is Natalia's only home. Lately, she has mentioned feeling like an unwanted guest. Begging a second pardon, Senora, but it was impossible not to laugh at the sight of you standing there at the table, decorating it for the party, with red carnations in both hands and one in your mouth. You looked like Carmen. What are you laughing at? You think it's so simple to create history? Long skirt sweeping the floor like a broom, moving around the table, carefully laying out the long-stemmed carnations on the white tablecloth. The pattern looked like a huge eye, the long stems as eyelashes radiating outward like rays of the sun. It's true, dining tables are part of history. The painter's walls and Lev's wax cylinders are not the whole story. The senora frowned, already picking up the flowers again before the design was finished, commanding, "Fetch the scissors," without even looking up, snipping the heads of the carnations from their stems, working so quickly that trails of blood might have begun flowing from her fingertips, like one of her paintings. Then she put a hand on her hip and held up the scissors, menacing the air. "We're going to have dancing tonight. A lot of handsome artists. Belen and Carmen Alba told me you dance the sandunga and jarabe perfectly. I will not even ask how they know this. But how did you learn?" "From my mother." "Your mother, a nationalist? I had a different impression." She would deny it now. She had a flirtation with it when we first came to the city, but now she's moved on to the age of swing and well-paid engineers.
And do you renounce us also? Or would you dance with an Indian girl?
She held out her hand and moved like liquid, rolling herself up into the arm that received her, making a flirtatious snip with her scissor like a flamenca dancer with her castanet. Señora Frida is a confusion of terms. Sometimes like a stern little man, then suddenly a woman or a child, but in every form demanding that you remain in love with her, commanding even her giant of a husband, until he runs off to be rescued by softer, pillowy women. This is the truth and not an opinion. Her cat smile, those hands, the paintbrushes, any one of them can be like a slap across the chest. After an hour's work, she was satisfied with the arrangement of red flowers on white linen. "Here will be Lev's place," she said quietly, "and here Natalia's." Uttering that second name as if her place at the table were a concession. Jealous of Natalia? Frida, is it possible? It's a lot of work to use flowers as paints. By the time the party ends, there'll be a mess of wilted petals, stains on your white tablecloth that could have been prevented. But you whirled around at that suggestion, looking fierce, lips pursed, the hand on your red rebozo, those silver earrings caressing your shoulders like hands.
Unnecessary stains and dead flowers? Sorry, excuse me, but what else do I have for making my marks on life? If not, lo absurdo y lo fugar.
You wanted to know how to say that in English. The absurd is easy. The other is more difficult. Fugar means things that run away with time. What would we do without the absurd and the running away? That was the moment when the door flew open. Bang! And of course it was Diego, carrying books and jacket, dropping things as he went, his boots hitting the tiles like cracks from a rifle as he crossed the room, kissed you, took the flowers away, and began to rearrange everything. All your work, you, everyone in the room, it all vanishes in the presence of Diego. Always right, because he is always riveting. For La Frida, there is El Diego and nothing else. A long time ago, at school, there was a boy like that. Bullseye. Always right, even when he was wrong. Once you said it would be necessary to confide in you, Frida. Sooner or later, one pierced soul to another. That maybe you could help. Since you are the only one reading this report each week, here is the confession you requested, the scandal of irregular conduct. For the insolito, there was bullseye and nothing else. Insolito means ridiculous. It means all those things you said, absurd and running away. Where would you be without lo absurdo y lo fugar? Maybe you're also lonely in this house, and you were asking, my friend, what would I do without you? 16 May. The press reports that Mr. Browder of the American Communist Party has come here to warn Mexican communists against any communication with Trotsky. He says unity at all costs means supporting Stalin. Lombardo Toledano and many other Mexican party leaders have dined at the Rivera's table, eaten the food of this kitchen. But Diego's membership in their party is now revoked. They all ignore his invitations to come here and meet with Lev. The heat is unbearable. Van goes out to a bar at night, the Golden Earring, just to get some air, he says. Lorenzo goes along, hoping to meet girls. "Do you want to come too?" Van asked. But probably the bar would be just another airless place. 1 June. The commander-in-chief of the Red Army, executed for treason.
Tukhachevsky had expressed support of Trotsky's position, and for this reason only, he is dead. Lev dreads there will be a purge, thousands of officers affected. Nothing else here to report. June 4. A telegram this morning from Liava, as always in code. The purges in the Soviet Union are terrible. The chief of the Soviet Secret Service has resigned his post in protest of the killings and announced his loyalty to Trotsky and the Fourth International. Lev fears for the safety of Chief Rice, but is cheered by news he has broken from Stalin. A congenial day in the office, despite sweltering heat. Lev had the big red work table from his office carried outside to the courtyard. The commissar was quite a sight, working in his big straw hat and old-fashioned Balbriggans. Even Van has finally stripped from gob shirts to V-lines, and over the course of the day, his great Dutch shoulders began to glow. Tonight, they are nearly the same maroon color as the desk. This afternoon, he knocked over the ink bottle and laughed about it for a change. His sympathies are improving. He gratefully accepted help with changing the typewriter ribbon, and later with a repair of the electrical cord of the Ediphone. He complimented a small correction in a translation, saying, "We make a fine team." Who knows where else the pair of us might work, outside of these walls, if such a day should come. 5 June. Senora Frida's wish this evening was to dine intimately with the visitors. Natalia is not well and remained in bed. Van went out for the evening. 8 June. Let it be noted. Every time Senora Frida brings out a tray of tea, the commissar lights up like the sun. He used to bear interruptions with polite tolerance. Now he glances up often to see if it's time yet for another, listening for the jingle of bracelets. Van agrees Lev's behavior is strange. Today, Lev and the senora went in the automobile to Senora Cristina's house on an undisclosed mission and stayed several hours, not for the first time. The lack of security is extremely worrisome. Frida, this is not an opinion. 10 June. Today, while Lev was out for the afternoon, he instructed the office should be well cleaned and the table moved back indoors. Rains are expected. Evidently, the commissar didn't expect such a thorough tidying up. Van found a box of letters that worry him greatly. The nature of these letters may be known to Senora Frida. The new workers need not only your husband's murals, but also what you offer. Beauty, truth, passion. True art and revolution are joined at the lips and the heart. Some letters, even more explicit, had been placed inside books he's borrowed from Senora Frida. He means to return these later, evidently. The letters remain in place. Tonight, Van paces like a prisoner around his cot in this tiny cupboard of a room. He sucks on licorice pastilles when he is anxious, after first laying out the evening's ration end to end, as Mother used to do with her cigarettes. Can we say anything about this to anyone? How could we? Van is desperate for his chief's safety. And feels loyalty to Natalia as well. He has lived with them so many years. He wants this behavior explained, but not the explanation. For the sake of heaven, he keeps saying, alternately pacing and slumping onto his cot. His broad shoulders and white V-shirt glow in the darkness of this bedroom with its closed-up windows. I thought she looked up to him as a father. For the sake of heaven, she calls him el viejo. The old man is only 5 years older than Diego. Maybe she says that to disguise her feelings. Bricked into this tiny cell,
two men, wrapped in heat like a blanket, whipped into two entirely separate frenzies. At the root of each man's distress, although from entirely separate quarters, the damages wrought by love, the cruelties of sexual attraction. He hasn't any notion. In a moment, he will be naked. It happens every night. Innocently, he lays out his body, piece by piece, like a banquet. His long, flat belly like a white flour tortilla. His beautiful feet extended beyond the wildest hopes of his little cot. How can they be so foolish? He keeps asking. Love can be like a sickness, Van. They didn't want it to happen. 11 June. Four of Signora Frida's paintings will be included in an exhibition at the National University. Likely she is happy about it, though she has not mentioned this or anything else of a personal nature since the last inspection of this journal. She comes to the house almost daily to see Lev, but avoids the staff. Most especially, she avoids Van. The personal confidences of her cook, for which she has earnestly asked on several occasions, have gone unnoticed here, or at any rate passed without comment. June 12. An unforgettable outing. Strange and wondrous, but in the end, bitter humiliation. The confidences of this report have been used against their author. Fact, not opinion. The workings of a household are like those of the world. The Russians tolerate Stalin's tyranny, Lev says, only because they know nothing else, from centuries of isolation under the Tsar. So it may be here as well. So it may be with a mistress whose cruelty merely contains her past. Cruelties imposed on her by a husband, or life itself. Yet, as Lev said at his trial, our best task is to move forward without insisting others slide backward. The authorized reporting of history, then. Signora Frida proposed the outing as a kindness to all, to escape this insufferable heat. But Natalia, of course, is still unwell. And Diego, too busy even to be told about the outing. The escapees included only herself, Lev, and his two secretaries. Two pairs like playing cards in her hand. She arranged it with more than the usual secrecy and drove the motor car herself, because Cesar can't keep his mouth shut, she said. And that much is true. A long drive to the dusty edge of the city, out to the Embarcadero. Xochimilco is a strange village, farm fields that appear to float on the water. Really, they are built-up islands, farmed since the time of the Azteca, when this city still stood in a lake. The canals and square farm islands are the last evidence of what lies beneath all this history and claptrap called Mexico City. Señora Frida lectured with great flair during the drive, sometimes letting go of the steering wheel to wave her hands, telling how the ancients supplemented their diet of frogs by making these islands for growing vegetables. How the layers of water lily leaves and fertile mud are built up inside a fence of interlaced reeds until the island gets above water level and the farmer can plant his crop. Now it is a mad maze of colors and cool water. Squash and cornfields, floral explosions, with waterways running on a perfect grid between the island fields. Angels' trumpets dangle their pink bell flowers over the water, and white herons stand one-legged among the reeds. Giant old poplars tower along the borders of each field, shading the watery lanes. You can see how it's all constructed. They begin by planting these poplar saplings in a rectangle under the water, for anchoring the interlaced reeds and poles that will become the island's perimeter. Now the saplings planted long ago are ancient leafy giants, with coral beans crowding in thickets between them. Some islands have the farmers' reed-thatched huts built right upon them, with children running and swimming from one to the next, naked as fish. Women cast lines into the water, or hawk jugs of pulque to the boaters passing by. Every side channel offers another thrilling glimpse, a long ribbon of shining green water overarched with a tunnel of trees. The passenger boats made for the canals are broad, flat-bottomed trajineras. Gaudy, duck-like things, every one is painted up in red, blue, and yellow, with an arch across the front of each one spelling out a woman's name in flowers. Made to order with each hire. Frida and Lev had a dispute when they hired the boat. She wanted to call it Revolucion. Not the best, Van pointed out, for the security of our comrade guest. Lev prevailed, and the boatman spelled out Carmen, Senora Frida's first name. She snuggled up happily with the old man on the bench on their side, with Van and H.S. on the other bench, two pairs facing one another across the plank table. All the boats have one, a long, narrow table, for picnicking, bolted right in, running from prow to stern. Ours was painted the brightest yellow, which seemed to suit Frida's mood. She would know a name for this color. The canals were jammed with these boats, all painted with similarly violent imagination, bobbing with couples and families escaping the city's heat, pushed along by boatmen with poles. The farmers in canoes full of vegetables had some trouble poling between the traffic jams, making their way out to the marketplaces of the city. A canoe swept by carrying marimba players, two men in white shirts standing side by side at their long instrument of wooden blocks, rolling their hands over the rippling wooden notes. Frida tossed the marimba men a few pesos to play the Internationale. Other boatloads of musicians bobbed past also. The place was filled with them, even a whole mariachi band standing up in their canoe, entirely precarious, balancing the enthusiasm of song with their will to keep dry. It was a wild, floating marketplace. Men selling flowers, women with giant aluminum pots balanced in tiny boats pulling up alongside to sell you a lunch, roasted corn, pollo mole, carne asada and tortillas, handed up into your boat on crockery that would be washed afterward in the canal. Lev bought a bunch of red roses and tucked them one by one into Frida's crown of braids. He poured glasses of red wine for all of us and then refilled them. He paid a band to play Cielito Lindo and then 12 or 14 other songs, all about the heart and not one concerned with the revolution. When he leaned out over the water to pay the musicians, he forgot to let go her hand, which he was holding under the table. The lovers were quite on display, cuddling all the afternoon, her little elbow folded neatly against his. Van looked away, listing various sights as we passed by them in a childish way that was very unlike him, thanks to his discomfort. It would have been just as well to stare at these two. They make a better physical match than the little dove and the toad frog. A more pleasing alignment, the Indian girl and her compact Russian peasant. Across from them, the Nordic god and native typist were shoved so close together on the bench, every turn of the boat pressed some part of a leg or shoulder against another. The air was breathlessly still. A cottony hot roar that swallowed everything. Heat and music, a pounding pulse. Van close enough to touch his cheek or clasp his knee. It took everything not to do it. Then, suddenly, loud screaming split the quiet. Our sleepy boatman raised his pole in alarm, but it was only a boatload of schoolgirls. They came alongside, waving wildly, with another boat following behind in right pursuit. That one, of course, filled with schoolboys, splashing and hurling flowers at their victims. "It's a war of flowers!" the girls shrieked, launching back long-stemmed arrows across the water. They fell short every time, like the Azteca warriors uselessly slinging arrows at Cortez, just before their hearts were blown apart with cannon fire.
En garde! Cried Frida, arming herself from the bower encircling her head, tossing roses in every direction. Lev also threw some flowers, a probable first in his long career as a militant. Frida reached into the water to catch a long-stemmed carnation and pointed it like a sword, swiping Lev's cheek and then his chest. I am hit! He cried, clasping his chest in mock drama, falling back against the bench. Struck in the breast by a posy. What do you call this one? Encarnado, she said. Descargado por encarnado, he said. Carnal wounds. Injury may be mortal. She kissed his cheek. Van looked carefully at the trees. The two boatloads of warriors moved away down a side canal, leaving the water behind them clotted with their colorful ammunition. Another canoe approached, and a man selling toys climbed aboard our boat, his pockets filled with trinkets of woven palm leaves. Any children here? No, Frida said, and Lev said yes at the same time. Van explained, I'm afraid the children have all gotten away. Well, this one is indispensable for people of any age. The man pulled from his pocket a long woven tube. A trapanovio. You had better try it, senorita. He held it toward Frida, who obligingly put her finger in the end of the tube and then made a show of not being able to escape. Everyone knows this trick. The weave of the tube holds tighter, the harder one pulls away. Senor, you'll have to buy it now, and hold on to the other end yourself, the man told Lev, extracting from him 5 pesos. Otherwise, she'll have this dangerous device for catching boyfriends entirely at her disposal. Who else here needs to trap a few novias? You, young men? That one, maybe, said Frida, laughing, pointing across the table. He's desperate to trap a particular novio. There was no need to say it like that. Novio, the masculine form. But forget about the other one. She tugged her trapped finger free of Lev's grip, its long prosthesis still attached, and shook it at Van as if he were a naughty child. He needs no devices for trapping girls. Apparently he has his own equipment. What time is it now, 4 o'clock? They're already lined up waiting for him at the Golden Earring. What is this? Lev sat forward. You go to that bar at night? Not every night, and the girls don't make a queue. Oh, I've heard some stories, Frida said. She seemed quite intoxicated, but maybe it was an act. She can seem that way at any time for her own reasons. The toy man sensed that he had stepped in the pie and scurried back to his canoe. What is this, Van? Lev asked again, seeming interested, but not disapproving. You didn't tell me about any girls. Van blushed acutely. Not girls. One girl. Her name is Maria del Carmen. Maria del Carmen, Frida sang. So this boat named Carmen carries more than one torch. Tell me about this young lady. Is she a bar girl? A waitress. But educated at university. She tutors me in Spanish sometimes in the evening. Oh, very good, very good, Frida said, smiling ferociously. A cat with the mouse beneath its paw. University educated and pretty, I have no doubt. Tutoring you in Spanish. Have you learned this one yet? Esternón? She touched her breastbone, leaning forward, and then cupped her own breasts in her hands. What about pezones? Van's complexion gave over completely to his blush. His ears and even the back of his neck. I know the words, if that's what you are asking. She stood up and leaned across the table, close to his face. Y besos suaves? Lev pulled her back by the hand. Frida, he's a man, not a child. If he has a lover in the town, it's not your concern.
Everything is my concern, mi viejo. Lovers, most of all.
The looks she gave to Van were smoldering. She worked the woven boyfriend trap gently off of her finger and studied it for a moment, before tossing it across the table to the object of no one's desire.
Insolito, you're the one who needs this. Better go trap yourself a different fish.
June 14. The household has exploded. Diego and Natalia learned of their spouse's affair, leading to the unpleasantness one could reasonably expect. Lev left this morning for a house in the desert at San Miguel Regla, loaned on short notice by trusted friends of Diego. When Senora Frida came to the house today, Natalia made a very painful spectacle of her anger. Poor Belén was so frightened she dropped a plate of fritters. Of course, Van went with him, and Lorenzo also, but not the other bodyguards. Lev says he can't impose an army on the hospitality of the Rivera's friends, even if they support the Fourth International. Diego fears the place can't properly be guarded. And to complicate the arrangement, Diego may count himself among those lined up to assassinate his comrade guest. Frida seems both disconsolate and unrepentant. A strange mix. Surely, Senora, you don't blame anyone but yourself. You wanted to be discovered. That was obvious. Remember what you asked for in these pages. A history without deceit. 17 June. In the kitchen, the stories burn hotter than the stove. Perpetua says Senora Frida went up to San Miguel Regla yesterday on the excuse that she needed to give some money to the Landeros family for taking Lev in their house. Perpetua clucked her tongue. What business could she have up there except monkey business? But once you're on the horse, you have to hold on, I suppose, even if he bucks.
That old man must have spice in his sauce yet, said Carmen Alba.
Old? Perpetua spat. He's not even 60. You girls are children, you don't know. The longer the sauce cooks, the spicier it gets.
Belén kept a nervous eye on the kitchen door, fearing the wife of the sauce in question.
30 August. A telegram came yesterday. Lev's former secretary, Erwin Wolf, murdered in Spain by the GPU. Natalia felt someone should take the sad message to Lev. It was a quiet drive to San Miguel. Cesar seems more than ever suspicious, even though he no longer has to share his room with the notebook-keeping spy. The road to Regla passes near the great pyramids of Teotihuacan. Then through little mountain towns, steep streets filled with taverns, donkeys, and dust, and pink colonial mansions from an earlier time, before it was shameful in Mexico to be rich. Now the mansions are all apartments, displaying laundry from their balconies. Lev's place at San Miguel Regla is a small apartment at the back of a large hacienda. It seems safe enough. A high wall and Lorenzo posted at the window, in a desert outpost visited mostly by vultures. The Landeros are rarely in residence. The family and servants, in any case, asked not to approach the rear of the house. With no women around, the rooms shared by Van, Lev, and Lorenzo look like drawers in a giant cabinet, the beds swimming among notebooks, pistols, shoes, and inkwells. If Lev stays much longer, he may drown in his river of paper. Lev finds the desert air invigorating and takes long walks each morning on the empty roads. He has fallen in love with cactus, finding 100 varieties populating the dry ravines. To Van's dismay, he digs them up, wraps them in burlap coats, and carries them home on his shoulder.
Somehow, he plans to make a garden of these bizarre prickled creatures. Van seems prickled also, maybe missing life at the Golden Earring. The return trip was even slower due to Cesar's somnambulant driving and the anticipation of Natalia's poor eager face, the small bulldog sniffing for her absent master. She'll have to be told. Lev indicated no plans for returning soon. He doesn't mean to neglect her. It's only his pure fascination with life as it is, however it is. For any homeless wanderer, he is a miracle of instruction. Now that he is exiled from every place on earth except a desert wilderness, he declares a passion for cactus. Here, very little is to be done. Cooking for unemployed bodyguards and Natalia, who hardly eats. She has survived 6 weeks now on lemon juice tonics and Fanoderm. Every afternoon at 2 o'clock, she parks her black shoes like two tiny automobiles beside her bed and lies down, fully dressed, to survive the remainder of the day. One of the messages carried to Lev concerned a visit from Joseph Hansen, a comrade from the Trotskyist Party of the United States. Natalia sees hope in it. Lev's true appetite, she says, is for his work. The arrival of Hansen will bring him back. 8 September. Lev returns, as predicted, and with him the flood tides of paper. Idle days gone. Van works all day transcribing the wax cylinders, while Lev generates more. The typing is endless, interrupted only by the security drills. Our menage is stirred like a soup. Diego wants Mr. Hansen and his wife Reba to have one of the connecting rooms. So all the guards will now share one tiny room, unless one would share a bed with old Perpetua, who snores like a boar pig. The house girls made a pallet under the fig in the courtyard so they can get some peace. Members of the staff feel more than ever like inmates because of the crowding and extreme security measures. The threats are real. This is understood, but not easy. Velen and Carmen Alba can't visit their mothers. The door is rarely opened. Even a trip to the market has to coincide with the change of guards, so as to interfere less with Lev's work schedule. Van has ceased his nocturnal visits to the tavern. The bodyguards sleep with pistols in their belts. The possibility of death waiting behind every knock. The heat of summer has abated, and nothing is as it was. 12 September. Arrival of Joseph Hansen and his wife, Reba. Lev and Joe are so happy to meet, they stayed up all the night talking. Reba helped make up extra beds, stuffed mattresses on the floor of a tiny room where now 5 men will sleep when not on duty. Reba apologized terribly and offered to share Perpetua's bed. Diego didn't forewarn her about the number of people already living here, probably because he neglected to notice it himself. She nearly wept. "And tomorrow you'll have to feed us all. You must be tired of salvaging these men who are saving the world." Hansen means to write a biography of Lev. In that case, this recording of events may no longer be necessary. Mr. Hansen understands politics far more perfectly and can record conversations objectively, not laced with an ignorant cook's prejudices for sweet and salt. History can fall into more capable hands. In any case, a record maintained to another person's standard is no real comfort to the spirit. Let it here be said. The writer understands this assignment was intended as a kindness, for which he is grateful. But the task has no freedom in it. A record meant for another's eyes is not recording, but spying. September 16. Frida. Carmen Frida Kahlo de Rivera, to be precise, and Van. were discovered sleeping on the pallet under the fig tree, where the house girls usually sleep, but were tonight sent home to their families for the national holidays. Recorded here for history, the couple lay with limbs entwined, his great white arm sheltering her small curved body. Her black hair surrounded both of them, rooting them to the bed as if they were growing there, a single plant. They seemed consoled by sleep, unaware of an observer who had consumed some beer earlier in the evening during the Independence Fiesta and hoped to deposit a secret piss in the geranium bed. The pair did not know they had been discovered. Apparently, they still do not. The observation is here reported. Some madness of penned dogs infects this camp. November 7. The Dewey Commission formally acquitted Lev of every accusation from the Moscow trials. After months of deliberation, they have released their written verdict to every nation. Of course, Stalin still wants him murdered more than ever. And the American and European newspapers that made him guilty in the first place have barely reported the Dewey Commission. Diego says the gringos are watching Hitler with a nervous eye, especially now with the Anschluss and the Rome-Berlin Axis. He says Britain and the United States will want Russia on their side if there is a war. So they can't let Trotsky be right about Stalin being a monster. They are going to need that monster. Still, a cloud has lifted, in time to celebrate Lev's birthday and the October Revolution. The Riveras made the largest ever fiesta, hired marimbas, the patio and house filled entirely. The security men nearly exploded from nerves. The guests are not artistic communists anymore, but peasants, white-trousered men in huaraches, unionists who support Lev. The women entered shyly with their heads down, braids nearly sweeping the courtyard stones. A few brought live chickens as gifts, their feet tied nicely with henequen ribbon. But the cooking for this fiesta started a week ago. Senora Frida was especially extravagant in a gold Tijuana blouse, green skirt, and blue shawl. She arrived with a large parcel wrapped up in paper, a portrait of herself, a birthday gift for Lev. Somehow, it did not get presented in the middle of so much celebration. People were already sleeping on chairs and window ledges, and it was halfway to morning when she came in the kitchen demanding, "For the love of Petrograd, can anybody tell me why we celebrate the October Revolution on the 7th goddamn day of November?" Belen asked Van the same question. Apparently, it took more than a month for the Russian proletariat to overthrow 7 centuries' worth of oppression. "Well, according to Diego, you should go to bed now. He says it's inappropriate to have the servants spend more than one day making so much food to honor the 10 million starving peasants." "Don't worry. All the other oppressed cooks have already gone to bed. I was just cleaning the chocolate pots. And I'm sorry to report it, but the cooking for today started a week ago. What does Diego expect? For you to do that kind of work yourself?" She sank delicately into one of the wooden chairs at the yellow table, perched like a canary. "Oh, Soli, you know that frog and me. We can fight about any stupid thing. Not to mention the things he doesn't know about." You looked up then, with a child's dread, clutching your shawl as if it might protect you from bullets or ghosts. How interesting to discover the power to frighten you. "When mankind is exhausted, he creates new enemies," Lev says. "The qualities of cruelty are spontaneous. Our best task is to move forward." "Frida, forget it. Nobody will tell Diego about you and Van. It only went in the book so you would know you've been seen. You can tear out that page. But as the wife of a man who keeps a Luger next to his dentifrice, you could be more careful."
I thought you would be furious because of Van. Fury demands a fire. For Van and me, no hope of a fire, as you pointed out that day on our boat outing. Had you already been with both of them back then? You make me sound like an animal. A madness of penned dogs. That's cruel. It wasn't you who surprised me, only Van. And Lev, too. They seem such moral fellows. Forgive me for putting it that way. For once, your eyes stayed steady, trained on the question, not looking for the door. What do you know about love? Nothing, apparently. That it winks on and off like an electric bulb. You seemed to be excavating your soul to locate some kindness. People want to be consoled. You're so young. You still have a lot of time for being moral. You're only a few years older, as you've said. But old anyway, with all my patched-up parts. I'm as doomed as all these men, for lesser reasons, of course. The pots were all shining now. Nothing more to do. Soli, there's an ache in this house. Tomorrow anybody could get a bullet in the head. Men like Diego and Lev have to make their vows of sacrifice. Better to live on your fucking feet than die on your knees and all that. But under all that fatalism, they want life. Who doesn't want life? But they do, more than most. They want it so badly they shake the world until its teeth fall out. It's why they're the men they are. And Frida can help them to be alive when she feels like it. It was only that one night with Van. I think he had a lot to drink. But you can never tell with the big, quiet ones. He's dying of loneliness. Who is, Van? Yes. Did you know he had a wife? Van is married? He was, to a girl in France. They were very young when they met, I gather, both working for the party. They had a little boy. The wife's name is Gabrielle. She wanted to come here, but Natalia wouldn't have it. Apparently they had quite a row. You know how protective Natalia is. She thinks of Van as her son. It's understandable, after all they've been through. Her losses. You're right. Forget about Diego. I think Natalia would kill me if she found out about Van and me. A wife. Van had a wife named Gabrielle. He has a son. This is what it means to be alone. Everyone is connected to everyone else. Their bodies are a bright liquid life flowing around you, sharing a single heart that drives them to move all together. If the shark comes, they will all escape and leave you to be eaten. This is the last report. November 7, 1937. Koyokan Notebook. 25 April 1938, initialed VB. Mother is gone. Dear God, in whom she never could believe, please let her not be alone in some drear heaven without men or music. Salome, motherless mother, never more than a child herself, dead with her heart in the wrong place. In the beginning were the howlers. Mother and son joined in terror of the devil stalking from above. No matter how many times men told her, it's nothing, it's a practical matter. Write down the story of what happened to us, she said. Promise me, so when nothing is left but bones and scraps of clothes, someone will know where we went. She said to begin this way, they are crying for our blood. But how can the story end so soon and so bitterly? Salome in a shattered sedan with her heart dislocated one last time. Nothing left but bones and scraps of clothes. Who can say where she went? The new beau was a foreign news correspondent. They were dashing to the airfield to catch a glimpse of a daredevil pilot said to be landing there for just a few hours. A stunt flyer, planning later this year to circle the world. These men with their great plans. The correspondent is an Englishman, Lewis. Probably he promised Mother the chance to meet famous people at the airfield. Instead, they met head-on with a truck coming from Puebla, carrying cattle to market. Some cattle escaped. Lewis suffered a broken collarbone and lacerations from flying windshield glass. But it was on Mother's lap that the engine of his Studebaker came to rest, causing what the doctor called a spontaneous pneumothorax. It means that a hole ripped in one lung suddenly let out all the air, pulling the heart into the right half of her chest, tearing it thus from the position it held for 42 years without ever settling in completely. Maybe for those last few shivering beats it was at rights. Maybe her heart stopped yearning to be somewhere else. Lewis told what he remembered of it, offering condolences from a bed in the English hospital. His head was bandaged like a mummy from the films. "You're the son," the mummy observed. "She said you were planning on university to be a solicitor." He had only known her a short while. Didn't feel entitled, really, to say anything at a funeral. Diego, with usual generosity, paid for the casket and a special mass, despite his atheism, and despite Mother's. The mistake passed unnoticed among the few friends gathered, none of whom had known her in life, just the one son, bearing up the weight of his own bones and damp, unmanly grief. What a raging, salted wound! That sad little passage, what arrogance the world holds against women like Salome. So many salons she has entered on the arm of a beau, always ready to charm the necessary bureaucrats of this world. Yet, in the end, no one proved willing to escort her out of it. How could a life of such large hopes be so small in the end? Her last apartment, one room above a lace and girdle shop. One trunk of frocks and phonograph records donated to a co-worker. Every casa chica was smaller than the one before. Were the beau less generous over time? Her assets less marketable? If she had lived to be old, would she have resided in a teacup to be sipped at intervals beneath some gray mustache? At least she made the papers, departing as she did. A small note in the big news extra about a daredevil flyer called Howard Hughes. Among the press mobs, a foreign correspondent was injured and female acquaintance killed in a collision while speeding to the site on the Viaducto Alemán. Her mark on history, the female acquaintance. 26 April. Lev couldn't attend the mass, of course, for safety, but continues to say he was sorry for that. His whole body winced the morning of the news. He and Natalia are raw at every edge since Liova's murder in February. In a Paris hospital, where in heaven's name any person should be safe. They have no children left now. Only the grandchild, Seva, from the eldest daughter. Lev's supporters are falling to a pogrom, everyone in the Vorkuta labor camp executed on the same day. And yet, the United States claims Stalin as an ally, still. They have offered to help extradite Lev for the purpose of execution. Ever since Cárdenas expropriated the American oil, the news promises sanctions will come, and maybe war. Francia Street last week filled up with students shouting, "Let the gringos come! We already turned back Napoleon!" Natalia takes Fanadorm morning and night, and cups of tea, one after another, drowning her sorrows, as Frida would say, until the damn things learn to swim.
but maybe some sorrows can't be borne. When Lev pauses in his work to stare out the window, his eyes are as cold as his children's bodies. The clear, bright future he once saw so plainly must now be charcoal lines drawn down to a vanishing point. Last night, he came out to the courtyard to smoke a pipe and talk, just memories, not necessarily ordered. He told about a dinner he had with Stalin many years ago, when no one yet saw the man as anything more than an ambitious, irritating young bureaucrat. They were sharing a bottle of wine with Kamenev and Dzerzhinsky, talking nonsense as young men do, and the question came up, what did each like best in life? Lev said the question exhilarated Stalin. He leaned forward on the table, gripping his knife like a pistol, leveling it at each one of us, and said, to choose your victim, to prepare everything, to revenge yourself pitilessly, and then to go to sleep.